This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusa in for Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. How long should police keep DNA samples of innocent people on file? We're talking about samples collected in the course of a criminal investigation. A year? 10 years? Maybe never. What role should a person's right to privacy play in determining the answer? There's a case in Massachusetts right now that's asking these fundamental questions about law enforcement and DNA privacy, and we're going to delve into the issue. But first, a little bit of background.
It starts with a very high-profile case, the 2002 murder of Krista Worthington. She was a fashion writer who was stabbed to death in her home in Truro. The murderer left DNA evidence at the scene, so as part of their investigation, Cape Cod police asked for cheek swabs from dozens of local residents.
One of them was a man named Keith Amato, and he says police asked him,
"Keith, we'd like a sample of your DNA in order to rule out the possibility that you were involved with this in any way."
Amato has a distant family connection with Worthington. He agreed to give the officer a sample of his DNA, but on one critical condition.
"And once I'm ruled out, I want it destroyed or given back to me in whole, not just a part of it, the whole thing." So yes, I made it very clear to him, and he absolutely assured me that that would happen, which was a blatant lie, obviously.
Now, Cape and Islands District Attorney Michael O'Keefe disputes that, saying no such promise was ever made to Amato.
Police did ultimately rule him out as a suspect, and after another man was convicted of Worthington's murder in 2006, Amato asked the state crime lab to return his DNA sample. They wouldn't, so he sued. The police eventually gave him the actual sample back.
But they retained the profile, the information about his DNA that was generated from the swab.
That's Mark Batten, Amato's lawyer who's representing him on behalf of the Massachusetts ACLU.
Now, if you've ever watched a standard TV police procedural, you've seen a DNA profile. It's a series of black and gray blobs that looks like a barcode. It's essentially Amato's DNA fingerprint, and it's still on file with state law enforcement.
So Keith feels that the information that is contained in his DNA profile, the most specific identifier of an individual that you can have, is loose in a government file that could be used for any purpose without his knowledge, without any kind of judicial oversight, without any kind of restriction.
And there's a reason for that.
Cape and Islands DA Michael O'Keefe.
Say, for example, the case was overturned on appeal and there was a new trial. Wouldn't one want the evidence that exonerated them and would prevent the finger from being pointed at them, so to speak, want that evidence to be retained in the case files?
Now, we should say that O'Keefe has been named one of the defendants in Amato's case. But essentially, O'Keefe is arguing that keeping an innocent man's DNA on file could help protect him from future unjust prosecution.
But here's where it gets complicated. There are strict privacy regulations when it comes to genetic samples collected by the FBI. In Massachusetts, there's also a Commonwealth statute that says the state cannot collect or maintain more personal data than is reasonably necessary for an agency to carry out its function. That's the basis on which Amato and the ACLU are suing the crime lab.
It turns out the state crime lab does have an established protocol for how long it retains evidence. It's called a retention schedule, and it says in certain cases they'll hang on to evidence for 50 years. But it's not a statute or a regulation or an executive order that's been through any kind of judicial or legislative oversight.
So really, Mr. O'Keefe holding on to this DNA and saying he has the right to hold on to my DNA for the next 50 years is really just an abuse of power.
So that's Keith Amato's opinion. It was not shared by a judge in Barnstable Superior Court who dismissed his case. Amato appealed. And last week, the state appeals court overturned the lower court and ruled that his lawsuit can go forward.
DNA information is highly sensitive, Judge David Mills wrote. Citizens have a reasonable expectation of privacy in such information. We are not convinced that O'Keefe and the state police have acted reasonably in this matter of law.
The court is saying, no, if you're going to retain this information, you have to tell us why.
Keith Amato's lawyer, Mark Batten.
Now, it may be that they'll be able to justify hanging on to Keith's DNA for some period of time, but so far they haven't been willing even to tell us why they need it.
So that brings us back around to this fundamental question of law enforcement and DNA privacy. Listeners, why do you think law enforcement needs to retain the genetic information of innocent people that they've gathered in the course of an investigation? Should they keep it? Is there a tension here between the state's duty to thoroughly investigate a crime and a citizen's right to genetic privacy? And if the police keep regular fingerprints on file, why not DNA? That's all in today's Talker, and we'd love to hear from you. So join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, in the studio now is David Lazar. He's an associate professor of political science and computer science at Northeastern University, as well as the director of the program on networked governance at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. David Lazar, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Sitting right next to you is Carol Rose, the executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. Carol Rose, welcome to you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, first, David Lazar, let me just ask you, what is your top line thought on where the Amato case stands? I mean, should law enforcement in Massachusetts be allowed to keep this sort of genetic profile for the 50 years that the state crime lab says it will retain the information?
Well, it's a tricky issue, actually. On the one hand, there are definitely privacy intrusions when your DNA profile is on record of the state. On the other hand, one of the things we have seen with the introduction of DNA in the criminal justice system is a revisiting of old cases. And so one of the issues that one of the policies that has been pushed around the country is retention of all evidence around cases, because finality in the criminal justice system isn't quite what it used to be. That is, the actual facts of cases have been revisited, and we've had exonerations occur and the like, and that has required revisiting old case files, old evidence and the like.
So, in fact, we've seen a number of such exonerations when people go back and look at the evidence in under a new light. But Carol Rose, I mean, it's the ACLU of Massachusetts that is arguing this case on behalf of Keith Amato. Your current take on why it is that you think DNA evidence should be completely destroyed after a case is closed?
Well, I think it's important to understand that this isn't DNA evidence that was taken as part of a warrant or because there was probable cause. In fact, this was voluntarily given in exchange for a promise that the DNA would be destroyed or returned, and all records of it would be destroyed or returned. In fact, the test showed that Mr. Amato, he was ruled out from the crime scene. And therefore, there's really no reason with regard to this investigation to keep it. If the government wants to collect DNA and keep it on file, they need to do so pursuant to a warrant. If they do so because a person gives consent, as Mr. Amato did in this case, the person giving consent has a right to put conditions on that consent.
Let me just jump in here and ask you, because Cape and Islands DA Michael O'Keefe says that because Keith Amato does have some kind of family connection to Krista Worthington, that his DNA falls into a different category than men who had no connection at all, who were asked, you know, on the street to provide a sample, and that it rises to a different standard of evidence and therefore should be retained for that 50 years.
If the DA wanted to go and get a warrant, a probable cause warrant to do that because he thought that Mr. Amato was a suspect, he had every right to do that. But that's not what he did. What he did instead was to say, I'm asking people to voluntarily give their DNA, and in exchange for that voluntary giving of the DNA, we will agree to destroy the DNA and not to retain it, because DNA isn't like a fingerprint. It's much more powerful. It can be kept and used. It reveals many things about you, your proclivity to illnesses, learning styles, a variety of things. And it reveals information about your family members as well. As actually Mr. Lazar wrote in an op-ed recently, he said, a DNA dragnet of a few hundred Cape Cod males could effectively include, indirectly, several hundred more of their biological relatives. So I think it's important that we realize it's not like a fingerprint. It's much more powerful and thus needs much more privacy protection.
Well, let me ask you, because this is a question that has sort of bubbled up in our office over the course of the day. What is the current regulation around the retaining of fingerprints, for example? Because that seems to be one of the analogous pieces of evidence that law enforcement does retain after an investigation. I mean, for innocent people who provide fingerprint samples, are those destroyed or are they kept on file?
Well, it depends. If they're collected in in exchange for a promise that we'll destroy it. The government can't lie. They can't set people up and say, we promise to destroy it or give it back because we want to have a rule-out sample. The problem with this from a public policy point of view is that if people agree to give, whether it's a fingerprint or a DNA or something else, in exchange for a promise from the government that they'll destroy that information, and then the government reneges on that promise and betrays that, people will stop coming forward. And that's bad for investigations. That's bad for public policy because we do want people to cooperate with criminal investigations.
David Lazar, let me get your take here.
Well, I think that a key and disputed fact here, I guess I do not know the facts, the specific facts of the case, is whether a commitment was made by the DA, by the state, to destroy the sample and the profile. And so if such a commitment was made, then it should be followed through on. And I think that there would be indeed negative consequences in terms of other people being willing to cooperate with law enforcement if such a commitment were made. I would add, and again, I don't know the exact details of the case, that there is a distinction between the sample and the profile, the digital profile that has been extracted from the sample. So from the sample can be extracted a lot of information, let's say medical information and so on. The digital profile can be useful for identity. It can also be used for identifying familial relationships. Mm-hmm. It does not carry some of the other baggage along with it in terms of, let's say, identifying proclivity toward or likelihood of getting disease in the future.
It does not.
It does not. Just the digital profile does not. At least that's the current.
Well, let me ask you about the issue surrounding DNA itself. I mean, when I talked to Keith Amato earlier today, I mean, one claim that he made was that it's different than other types of evidence because, in a sense, it is the most basic part of him. It is a bodily part of him rather than a photographic image or piece of video surveillance that someone might have caught of him that is put in a criminal investigation somewhere. And so that makes it qualitatively something that needs to be handled and treated differently by law enforcement. I mean, what's your take on that?
That's something that in certain respects is culturally constructed because there may be some cultures where you say fingerprints, and if we had been looking at this issue decades ago, we might have been talking about the sanctity of fingerprints in certain similar ways as we talk about DNA. Now, that said, there is certain information that DNA conveys regarding family relationships that's unambiguously the case that fingerprints do not. But fingerprints do a pretty good job of conveying identity. In certain respects, they can do a better job because they can distinguish identical twins, whereas DNA cannot. And the other thing I would note is that there are other kinds of evidence collected in the course of investigation that might have intimate information about people, like if you're investigating people's past relationships and the like, that might intrude on the privacy of innocent parties.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some comments here. Jose Michael Rodriguez writes on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Radio Boston. Law enforcement ideally should keep the DNA for no longer than an agreed upon time period to be decided by the Attorney General and rights advocates groups. Honestly, if the case is really closed, then they don't need it, especially if the DNA comes from an innocent party. Let's take another call along those lines. Melissa is calling from Acton. You're on the air, Melissa.
Hi, I'd like to get clarification on Mr. Amato's standing in this case, because I don't really understand. I mean, is the fact that he was to Krista Worthington, did that somehow make him more likely to be a suspect or something? Because from what I understand, he was never a suspect. He had the same status as this whole group of local men who were asked to submit samples. Is that not correct? Because then, if that's the case, then the DA's comment makes no sense to me at all and has a really smarmy ring of, I'm here from the government to help you, because basically what he's saying is, hey, just in case somebody might someday want to associate you with a murder with which you were never associated and from which you were never a suspect, we think we should really hang on to the evidence to help you.
Melissa, thank you so much for your call. I'm not sure if we can answer that in detail, but I will ask Carol Rose of the ACLU of Massachusetts what you can add to that.
I think it's really important to understand that, first, if they thought he was a suspect, they had all sorts of legal ways that they could have obtained his DNA without asking him to do so voluntarily. They did put him into a pool of people who gave their DNA voluntarily. After the fact, O'Keefe is now saying he didn't make that promise, but the court in their ruling actually said that, in fact, it appears that he did. So I think it's important to understand that we're going to find out more of the facts now, but the government was trying to dismiss it without even getting to the factual investigation. The second thing to understand is that they can, in fact, use the DNA profile, not only on this case, but on any other crime that comes up that they could run it against, because there's no protections. In contrast to, say, the fingerprint database, where there are protections, this is sort of a shadow database that the DA out on the Cape and Islands is keeping for himself. So the regulations that might protect in other DNA, in other databases, don't protect Mr. Amato or the other people.
Well, let me jump in and ask you about that in the last couple of minutes that we have, because this seems to be, at least in terms of action that can be taken at the state level, where the gray area lies. Because if I understand correctly, for evidence, as we mentioned earlier, that's collected by the FBI, for example, there are federal regulations that say, you know, what you can and cannot do with those DNA profiles, how they can be treated and used, etc. The state does have some laws in terms of the standards that have to be met to collect evidence. But here we have a case of local law enforcement using the power of DNA in an investigation. Are there no regulations whatsoever on the books in Massachusetts to give guidance on use and retention of evidence in this
case?
Well,
there is. There's the Fair Information Practices Act, which is why the court ruled that, in fact, he has a right, since he gave it voluntarily, to get access, to get it back, and to force the government to keep their promise. So that's the regulation that's on the books. It's important to understand what those other databases, those are for people who at the federal level are arrested or at the state level are convicted of a felony. So innocent bystanders, innocent people who offer to come forward to provide rule out DNA or other kind of evidence shouldn't be in those databases. That would be a vast expansion of databases that's pretty scary, and it would really discourage people from cooperating in police investigations. You know, Mr. Amato agreed voluntarily to do this, as did hundreds of other men on the Cape and Islands. There's really no reason that they should be punished for cooperating in a police investigation.
I mean, David Lazar, is this him being punished? Or, I mean, I can imagine a law enforcement official listening to this right now and really coming back to, you know, a statement that we've heard before, that if you have committed no crime and you have nothing to hide, why be fearful of law enforcement doing what it can to investigate a case? Or you know, retaining the evidence in relation to an investigation?
Well, yes. There are a couple of issues here. I mean, one is retaining all materials relevant to an investigation, but the second is following through on commitments made to individuals in the course of an investigation. And those are somewhat separate issues, right? Because you on the one hand, you want to retain what you can retain. On the other hand, if there are things that you've agreed to not to retain, then you shouldn't retain that information. Just one additional thing I'd like to say is that just to clarify vis-a-vis what can be done and the rules in the state, that there is a state DNA database system, but that a profile like this would not be allowed into the system. So this would really be something where if they, in an ad hoc fashion, say, well, let's go back and look at this case in the Cape, for example, that would be technically possible, but they could not use the state DNA index system to search through that information.
Does that solve the problem, Carol Rose? We've just got a few seconds left of this, of what you were calling a shadow database that exists on the Cape.
Right. It's important to understand that a database that's used to possibly lock someone up for a criminal purpose has a different purpose and thus different protections, and we need higher protections than a database that's just out there more generally. I think it's also important to note that in terms of the ability to use this evidence to exonerate in the future, since they actually did either destroy or return the actual DNA samples after our lawsuit, they have any ability to say you did the test wrong or anything has been destroyed. So in fact, I'd be surprised to hear the government say they think that they got the wrong guy, but they've already exonerated Mr. Amato, and now they need to abide by the promise they made to him and destroy the database.
Well, Carol Rose is the executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. Thank you so much for joining us today. And David Lazar, associate professor of political science and computer science at Northeastern University and director of the program on networked governance at the Harvard Kennedy School, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And listeners, this is obviously an important issue that's only going to grow in importance as DNA continues to be used in criminal investigations in the Commonwealth. So we'd love to hear what you have to think. Send us your thoughts at radioboston.org.